Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
Hello, everybody. Eric Klein here.
And we'd like to welcome back to the show Hannah McGregor, Assistant Professor of Publishing at Simon Fraser University. On episode 275, she joined us for a discussion about academic podcasting and peer-reviewed podcasts. And today, she's here to talk about Spoken Web, a Canadian project focused on the preservation of literary sound recordings. Hannah leads the Spoken Web's podcast task force and also hosts the Spoken Web podcast. Thanks for joining us, Hannah.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So, as I mentioned, Spoken Web is a project to preserve literary sound recordings. What exactly is a literary sound recording?
An excellent question. You know, the origin of Spoken Web as a project comes out of interest in digitizing and preserving the recordings of literary readings in Canada. So it's particularly attending to the event. Canadian literary history really was marked by this amazing surge of creative energy and activity in the 60s and 70s. And there's like a whole history there that we can get into if you're interested in how the Cold War influenced Canadian nationalism. But essentially, in the 60s and 70s, we've got this new generation of writers and lots of poets, and this kind of wild moment where like, poets became rock stars in Canada and would go to these like incredibly like packed events and do these amazing high energy readings. And a lot of these events were being recorded, and they were being recorded, you know, on 8-track and then later on cassette, and people would record them and then make copies for their friends and pass them around and, you know, bootleg copies of like this cool poetry reading I went to. And for the most part, these like weird audio archives like haven't been necessarily preserved in university archives. You know, a lot of the time they're in like somebody's trunk or a closet somewhere. They're part of people's personal holdings. So what Spoken Web is doing is finding these weird, interesting audio collections and starting to digitize them so that more people can hear them and so that we can study them.
And what's sort of the backstory of that? How did somebody have the idea of, because I can see how these might be sort of viewed as ephemera. And I know people that have these interesting recordings, you know, from the past in their collections. So what was the moment that sort of led to the idea that, wow, this really needs to be housed somewhere and really tended to as a collection?
I mean, it's part of a larger project of sort of digitizing and paying attention to forms of culture that we might have thought of as ephemeral, but that record important histories that might get lost otherwise. And it's definitely explicitly a project that's made possible by the kinds of digital technology we have now, right? That we can sort of do this work at our various institutions and then centralize things, that the infrastructure exists to do this now. But in the sense of, you know, whose idea was this, Spoken Web is a project that was created by Jason Camlott, who is a sound studies professor at Concordia University. And it really emerged out of him doing work on a very particular reading series that happened in Montreal during the 60s and 70s. And that was sort of the inspiration, starting with that collection, which has all been digitized now and which you can find entirely on the Spoken Web website. But that was sort of the starting point, work on that collection. And then out of that came this realization that, like, actually there are lots of other examples, lots of other interesting collections that we might want to digitize. So the most thoroughly digitized collection so far is the Sir George Williams poetry series, which is like 1965 to 1975. That's all online and you can go and listen. And it's got like great old, just like tons of names you'll recognize if you're really into 1960s and 1970s Canadian poets. But also like, you know, there's Allen Ginsberg on there. Like, you know, there's people who also you might have heard of. I say that just because I don't know how much of a household name Earl Burney is, but trust me, he's important. So that's all been digitized and is great. You can go and check it out. But other people have other similar interesting collections. So
I want to ask
to add to them.
I want to ask a very silly question. Why is he important? What, you know, because just to be brutal and honest, like in my mind for many of the years of my life, the idea of poetry was a very, I don't know where I got this idea. It's probably from television, but that people wrote poems about very abstract and, you know, I'm just assuming like a frivolous nature. And so I'm wondering what that particular poet that you just referenced, what was the nature of their work?
It's like, so it's the question, why is Earl Burney important or why is poetry important?
Yeah. Why is Earl so cool? Earl Burney?
Yeah. Earl Burney. I mean, he won the Governor General's Award twice. I mean, what we're looking at is to go back briefly to that sense of like a historical moment and why poetry played such a big role in that moment. So up until World War II, Canada is still functionally a colony, right? It's part of the Commonwealth. It lacks a lot of political and cultural independence from the UK. And World War II is when the British Empire broke up, right? Mm-hmm. And so post-World War II, Canada, one, is like, ah, dang, we're independent now. How do we start to articulate what we are as a nation? But almost more significantly, you know what world power was rising in the wake of World War II?
The United States of America.
Yeah, it was that one. And here we are right next to this emerging world power in the midst of the Cold War. And you have bombs and we don't. Mm. And there was genuine fear that Canada was going to be annexed by the United States. And so there's this report written in the 1950s that basically the Governor General of the time is called the Massey Report. And the Governor General of the time, which is the Queen's representative in Canada. This is Canada's weird. Basically said the best way for us to protect ourselves politically, mm-hmm, and sort of in a military sense is to create a unique and distinct culture so that we are culturally distinct from the US. And so all of these new forms of infrastructure started to emerge that were dedicated to like fostering and promoting Canadian culture. And one of the main forms that like distinct articulation of a local cultural identity was worked out was in poetry. Like, I think there really was, because it goes hand in hand with this moment. We're really experimental, right? It's the Beat Generation. It's postmodernism. People are really experimenting with what constitutes a poetic voice. What can poetry be? What can it sound like? And young writers in Canada are using that form to really work out, like, who are we? What kind of literature are we creating? What kind of communities are we imagining? So poetry becomes this incredibly potent site for like working through really complex, like political and cultural questions.
I love that. And I mean, it makes me think about even things today in Canada where I feel like there's more of an appreciation for experimental radio work, mm-hmm, you know, like, yeah, experimental audio, experimental sound over the radio, and artists that practice that. I feel like there's funding there for projects like that in a much bigger way than in the United States. And I'm curious, as you're talking about this poetry emergence, if you know of connections with radio at the time, too.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Tons of connections to radio at the time. And folks who are working on the Spoken Web Project are doing research, like deep research into these questions that include things like, you know, how was radio becoming one of the primary ways that poetry was shared at a national level? There was this radio series called Anthology that... I am pulling up the host right now because it's gonna, I feel like it was Robert Creeley, but somebody's gonna get, somebody, not you, but somebody's gonna get really mad.
I love this.
As
you look it up, I just want to emphasize the excitement that we feel that, like, you know, it's, we're jealous. Americans who love radio and who love the arts and experimental sound have a lot of reasons to be jealous of what of Canadian sound culture then. And especially, it sounds like that there is, you know, I think you said institutional support for the arts. My mind just goes straight mm-hmm. to a paycheck. You know, artists who are doing weird art on behalf of Canadian culture can get paid for that. You know, it's, they don't get rich, but they can still eat soup and live in a heated apartment.
Well, and what's most important about the way that cultural funding works here, that I think is really significant, is that the government funds these, you know, these various awards that go to both directly to artists, but also support things like publishers, right? There's like block grants that help keep small presses running. And those grants are funded by the government, but they are not distributed by the government. Which is to say the government takes an arm's length relationship to it. So it is juries of peers that decide what is funded and what is not. And so that means that it's like, here's some money for art, and artists get to decide what art should be funded. So it doesn't ever become a sort of an extension of the government's own agenda, which is really significant as well. But yeah, no, absolutely. Like, radio was really a piece of this, and there's lots of experimental poets of the time who are really interested, like, one, in playing with sound and its affordances, but two, also in playing with recorded sound itself. So the poets were also really interested in, like, what happens if you record something and then play it back and then speak over it? You know, what can we actually do with this kind of newly available technology that lets us play with sound and the nature of what we're creating?
That's awesome. I love that. Like, thinking about tape recorders as, you know, one of your instruments. And back to the spoken web project. So in these literary recordings that you're talking about, are there radio recordings that are also part of the collection that's being collected?
So one of the big challenges around that is that most of the sort of major radio that, you know, literature was being shared through was CBC, our national broadcaster. And CBC archives are difficult to gain access to.
Huh.
They belong to, you know, the CBC is like a government organization and it's their archives, and they don't make them super easy to find for scholars. So that has been, my colleague Catherine McLeod does really interesting work on the aforementioned anthology series and in general on the role that CBC played in circulating poetry during this period. And she's always, you know, struggling with getting access to archives. And then, you know, and this, as you might imagine, is a big challenge with the Spoken Web podcast, permissions. That even if you can hear something really neat, getting permission to use it and to recirculate it gets really tricky. But lucky for us, our team is full of very smart librarians and archivists.
Wow. Well, so you're taking a step that I think a lot of podcast producers never even contemplate for their own mental health, you know, the ability to move forward with their project, which is the licensing for the material that they're using.
Yeah, and that's, I think, particularly important with this kind of project for a variety of reasons, including that we're, like, funded by, like, the project as a whole is funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council in Canada. Speaking of funding, we also have generous national funding for research projects, and you don't want to do semi-legal things when you're funded by a federal funding body. But also, a lot of these archives, like these collections, right? I mentioned that a lot of the time they're not already in institutions. It's like, oh, this person just had them. And so a lot of the time, researchers are gaining access to these collections through personal relationships of trust that they are building with the individuals, right? This is the 60s and 70s. A lot of these people are still living, or it's, you know, their partner who we're gaining access to the collections through. So you're building relationships of trust. You want to ask permission. Yeah. You don't want to put things out there that people don't want to share.
That relationship of trust just came up in the last episode we recorded about
ethics and recording protests and materials from protests, and what are the ethics of you know, both archiving that information and making it accessible,
as well as the family members sometimes having feelings about how this material was going to be shared, as well as where, you know, the idea that sometimes black communities would think that the archiving of their materials would be weaponized against them in the future, especially if those materials were activist events and protests. So all of these issues. That was it's just echoes of last week.
So Hannah, you had alluded to the Spoken Web podcast. So maybe now's a good time just to talk a little bit about how the podcast aspect of this project is working to bring to light things from the archives.
Whew, yeah, thank goodness, because the podcast is the thing I'm an expert in, whereas the rest of the project, there are many other people who, like,
oh, good.
Noah, I was like, if they ask me how an 8-track works, I'm gonna have to be like, oh no, my internet broke up.
Why is poetry good, Hannah?
That one I feel comfortable with. I have a PhD in Canadian literature. I'm ready to go with those answers. So I was brought into the project specifically to help them to develop a podcast. And the idea was, this is a project that is working with sound-based archives. And the general way that you write about sound as a scholar is, like, you transcribe it and then you describe it. So if you're working with, like, an old sound clip, you know, you'll, like, write down what it says, and then you'll be like, and it has this quality, and they pause in these ways, right? You have to turn sound into a written artifact in order to do scholarship about it. But podcasting gives us a space where we can do not only do sound-based scholarship about sound, but take things even further and, like, incorporate the interesting affordances of sound into how we're doing our scholarship, so that as you're playing with the idea of, like, you know, how are, for example, there's a great episode of the podcast called How We Are Listening Now. That is Jason Camelot and Catherine McLeod thinking about how our relationship to sound has changed during the pandemic. And because they are working with a sound-based medium in order to make this argument, they can, you know, incorporate audio out of Zoom calls to, like, actually embed that specific experience of sound. But they can also play with, like, fragmenting the recordings in order to produce something that affectively feels the way it does when you are trying to talk to somebody and your internet starts breaking up. Or when describing the relationship between noise and signal, to actually, like, bring the noise in the recording up to, like, so you can hear, what does it mean for a recording to be noisy? So there's all of these possibilities for what you can do when you're talking about sound and using sound to do it.
One thing, I have, like, a very simplistic example where, when I was thinking about literary recordings and how it's different, you know, specifically about literary recordings, how it's different to hear versus read. I'm taken back to my junior high school classroom where my teacher had a turntable and she would play Shakespeare for us. So when we were studying Shakespeare, we would hear it being read. And so I was wondering if that resonates with any of the work that's being done with this collection to you.
I think it can. I mean, I think that there is a reason why the reading series remains a popular way for people to engage with poetry. I think poetry in particular, and, you know, Shakespeare falls into this history, is brought to life through the act of being spoken. And we historically primarily read out loud to each other anyway. So a lot of older texts were always meant to be read aloud and are hard to understand without reading them aloud. I've taught Paradise Lost a few times, and Paradise Lost is incredibly difficult to read in your head, because it's all about these like long sort of weirdly constructed sentences that have a beautiful rhythm to them out loud. Yeah. But when you're trying to hold them all in your head, just fall apart. But there are lots of ways in which poetry, which can feel, I think, difficult to access to a lot of readers. It feels like it's something like only poets read it, or only particular kinds of people, like poetry is only for certain people. But when you see or hear a poem being read, you can get a much better sense of its meaning that I think opens up the possibility of enjoying poetry for a larger audience.
And you've talked a lot about, you know, the whole spoken word collection sort of emerges from these readings that people were doing. So you're actually hearing the author doing the reading, which is different than hearing an actor reading Shakespeare.
Yeah, you're hearing the author's voice, and you're hearing their little introductions, and you're hearing them pause and take a sip of water, and you're hearing the audience, and you're hearing that weird, awkward moment where people try to decide if they're supposed to applaud or not, because it's never clear at a poetry reading if you're supposed to applaud. So, like, on one level, you get absolutely the way that this work is brought to life by the poet's own voice. And then on another level, you also get this amazing immersion into like the event, like the specificity of the location and the moment, that also is just really exciting.
Now I'm also just thinking about this moment that we had in the United States very recently, where Amanda Gorman at the inauguration gave this insanely incredible poem. And how many occasions do we have like that in...
She's going to be reading a poem at the beginning of the Super Bowl now.
That's right.
So poetry, you know, it's jumped. Amanda Gorman's poem was not the first time that a poem captured the American imagination when it was read at an inauguration. But I do think it's the first time a poet is going to be invited to open the Super Bowl.
Which, yeah, I mean, talk about America, United States of America. This is... sort of a watershed moment, and she's this rock star and even has presidential
24
aspirations
years
herself.
Old.
So I would love to hear your take on it, since you're part of this spoken web project and also doing a podcast. I'm sure that you've had conversations about this among your peers.
Absolutely not. No, we haven't talked about it at all, but I think that it is like a reminder. Like there's a lot of things that makes me think about, but one that I come back to time and again is, you know, there's a real politics to what poetry we canonize and then anthologize and then teach. And there is a tendency for us to collectively disregard occasional poetry. It's like poems that were written for a particular function or that were written to speak to a particular moment, right? We don't anthologize the poems people wrote for political events. We anthologize the like poems they wrote about urns that are also metaphors for something else. And so we lose, because of the way that we save some stuff and not other stuff, we lose the sense that poetry has always been deeply political and often deeply occasional, which is to say written for a particular purpose in a particular moment. And that we often turn to poetry to sort of mark and help understand the significance of moments. And then we don't save that, and then people get the impression that poetry is only ever about, like, waterfalls or trees, or, like, stuff that's like, I don't get why this is important. Like, why do I care about this dead guy thinking about walking in a forest? When it's like, well, but probably that dead guy also wrote poems about, like, war, like, and the things he was living through, and the things that felt urgent and timely. But then you don't save that stuff, and you lose this sense that, like, there is a reason you get a poet at an inauguration.
That, as you're describing this and talking about this idea of the canon, it also makes me wonder about, you know, the entirety of the spoken web project. And is it focused on certain types of authors and poets, or
yeah, or
I wanna, what is your definition of the canon for this project?
I want to piggyback on that question and ask, like, is there anyone in the spoken web archive whose voice is like rings out larger than their written work?
Oh yeah, I mean, those are both wonderful questions. There are lots of people who, for me, what I love most about them is their voice. Like, some people who I'm like, your poetry is great, but when I hear it, I like get it. My favorite example of that is Gwendolyn McEwen, who is a poet who she published a number of collections, but she was best known as a performer. And she was this really, she was like fascinated by Egyptian culture. And so she wore her hair very, very long, straight, dark hair parted in the middle. And she always had very dark eyeliner. And she was really, really performative. And she memorized all of her poetry. Mm. So it was always a performance rather than a reading. And everybody says that seeing her perform was just a completely arresting experience. And we don't have video, but we've got audio recordings where you can hear her voice. And that really like summons her in this powerful way. And there's other, you know, there's other examples of people who like historically who we hear were incredible performers, but getting to actually listen to audio of poets and performances can really bring them to life in that sense. The other thing that I would point to that is neat about the podcast is that, so the podcast itself is collaborative. Each episode is created by a different member of the team. Mm. And so it is a space where the people, it's like a huge group. There's like 40 people on this project.
Oh, wow.
At like 12 different institutions. It's a massive project. And so people are doing really different kinds of research. And the podcast is a space where the rest of us can find out about other people's stuff. But it's also a space where people who are like new to podcasting can try their hand at making a podcast for the first time, where people who just have an interesting research story to tell can like go on there and, you know, try telling their right. their interesting research story. So the diversity of topics on the podcast is like really expansive. Like the most recent or the second most recent episode is about West African talking drums. Mm-hmm. And like the technology of talking drums and how they work as both an art form, communication and a political tool. So it's not necessarily always like 1960s poets only, right? We're trying to use the space of the podcast in particular to expand our conversations about sound and how we talk about it.
Right. And this is in part because, as I think we talked about this the last time you were on the show, Hannah McGregor, but we've also talked with other academics who love sound and who are sort of sometimes it seems like, you know, they're building the boat as they ride the boat down the river. There's 1,000 years of academic work in the written word, and this is like the first generation of academic work in sound. And
yeah.
It hasn't been established yet that you can be an academic and a radio producer, right? I mean, it's happening today. And so that's really exciting that your spoken web podcast with dozens and dozens of academics contributing sort of is a part of that space. The other one I'm thinking of is Sounding Out, the Sounding Out podcast with our guest so long ago that names.
Well, and Sounding Out also, you know, the episodes of the Sounding Out podcast can take on a variety of styles with a variety of contributors. So it also seems to work in this collaborative way that you're talking about.
One of the nice things just thinking about infrastructure, right? Like how do you, you know, build the boat? You know, one of the biggest challenges of this project was just off the get-go, just figuring out like, how are we going to make a podcast that's created by a team of 40 people in 12 different institutions?
So how do you?
Yeah, how we do it is that we have an absolutely incredible supervising producer, Stacey Copeland, who is a PhD candidate here at Simon Fraser University, who also has a background in radio production. And so she is the person who, like, oversees the series sort of structurally and works with people to, you know, finalize the production of their episodes and just help, like, does that intermediary work of, like, some people come in fully ready to make an episode and other people come in like, how to podcast.
What's editing software?
What is, yeah. Exactly, right? And so part of what she does is, like, make up that difference, do the sort of one-on-one help that folks sometimes need. And then just sort of, we're always like walking that line between we want consistency because podcasting is a serial medium and people want some level of consistency. So, like, I am the consistent host. We have a consistent theme song and we want the production quality to be consistent. But within that consistency, we want to leave a lot of space for play so that people can do, you know, a more maybe conventional sort of audio essay or audio documentary, but also can do, like, somebody's working right now on doing a, like, podcasting edited edition of a text. So they're going to, like, read a short story and then do, like, footnotes for it. But as sound, I have absolutely no idea how it's going to work. But I'm really excited to find out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so is it monthly? Is that right? It's a monthly.
Yeah. So we do main episodes once a month. And then on the opposing fortnights, Catherine McLeod, who I've mentioned a few times before, she does a series called Shortcuts, where she plays just a little piece of audio out of the archive, just with a short introduction. So it's just a way to get little tastes of stuff that's already been digitized.
Oh yeah, talk more about Shortcuts. What sorts of things, what sorts of audio has she uncovered?
All kinds of stuff. So what she's doing with Shortcuts is basically sort of curating out of the existing digitized audio. So she's like, you know, the audio clips, I think, are usually like 3 to 5 minutes, so quite little pieces that are themselves playing with, like she's theorized the name Shortcuts in terms of that, like, media history of cutting and splicing, the way that audio can be sort of literally cut apart and put back together. And what she does is listen through and just find stuff that is interesting to her and then do that kind of contextualizing. So a lot of the time for me, what I'm hearing on the Shortcuts episodes are writers I've, like, never heard of before and audio clips I have never heard. What is the most recent one, which came out? It was the mid-January episode. Recording of Muriel Rukeyser reading in Montreal on January 24th, 1969. As you might be able to tell from my pronunciation, I had never heard of that person before. But she's finding just things that she's like, I was listening and I heard something neat here. So let's listen to this and hear this neat thing together.
That's a really wonderful... It goes into your podcast feed, and so it reminds listeners that you exist. And, you know, the episodes of your spoken web podcast are, you know, interviews with sound and voices talking. But then you have these shorter episodes that come in between those longer works that are just pieces of tape from the archive. It's a very natural way to include other work in the feed. Our episode talking to the Sounding Out podcast producer, Jennifer Stover is her name, and that was episode number 132 back in March of 2018. So we're coming up on 3 years. Ooh, since that episode.
Wow. That's amazing that it was that long ago.
I think it was really the first time we talked to an academic about sound.
I know, which I've been wanting to do for a long time, was to incorporate more academics and sound studies.
Half of
the podcast. I mean, at the risk of... at the risk of overselling spoken web, I really think you should have Jason Camelot on as well.
Sure.
Because he is a historian of audio recordings, amongst other things. And the things that the way that he talks about recorded sound in particular is incredibly exciting and interesting.
That's delightful. I was thinking about how when we had Jennifer Stover on, Sounding Out is a much older podcast. It comes from an earlier time in podcasting history, like 6 or 7 years ago, I think. And they really planted a flag on that not every podcast has to sound great, because not every writer, producer, not every voice has access to great equipment or, you know, the privilege to know how to use it. And they don't want to exclude people just because, just because something doesn't sound
right.
They
did sort of a manifesto about it.
Right, because so many people complained about
kind of
this.
A punk rock idea of, we get comments that this sounds terrible, and here's why access sometimes for us is more important, which is interesting. You know, there are a lot of different perspectives, and it's interesting that with spoken web, Hannah, you're talking about how you like to have a consistency of sound, a certain level of consistency with the same host and music and production value.
It also sounds like someone is being compensated for their work to maintain that level of audio production, which is really, part and parcel of
that's the
where
super
audio comes
significant
from.
Part for me is that what we were striving for was that kind of balance, right? That we want it to sound as good as we can get it, and also we want to make this as open to as many participants as possible of really varying levels of experience and comfort with the medium, including there's lots of students involved in the project. So we want students to feel comfortable just like trying this out. And so, you know, the nice thing is that because it's a funded research project, we can pay somebody with expertise. And luckily for us, somebody who not only has production expertise, but Stacey is also a scholar who is also studying the history of radio. She specifically studies the history of lesbian radio and podcasting. I'm just going to throw you a ton of guest recommendations.
Sure.
Stacey would also be great.
It happens. I mean, it's just amazing because just what I'm thinking of, and somebody, maybe there's an academic in the world who's thinking about this or wanting to, maybe it was me. There's just been a massive sea change, and the pandemic has really opened that up to our ears, that equipment now is just so diverse and available for talking into microphones that are recorded clearly by computers that work. Things have really changed in the last 5 years. It's really incredible. So
there's
a lot more good sound.
There's different schools of thought around that. Like I come 100% out of this punk rock background too. Like podcasting is interesting to me because I think it has some similar culture to zines. And I think independent and DIY publishing has continuously this really radical potential to give us space to do things otherwise that are not necessarily responsive to the demands of the market, and the way that market demands end up like exerting this really coercive like genre force, right? Once something's been popular, everything else after it has to sound like that thing. And I don't want to make stuff that sounds like what everybody else is making because that's boring to me. Mm-hmm. So that possibility of like, we can still do DIY stuff, we can still do weird stuff, we can still do amateur stuff, I think is really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. You're speaking to that direct line from zines to blogs to podcasts that we've talked about on the show before. And it's important to keep that in mind that podcasts have existed, prior to the corporate idea of podcasting.
And like the hobby horse that I will ride off into the sunset every episode is like, podcasts should not exist only to, hit the skyrocketing top of the charts and win, thousands of Patreon, like some podcasts need to exist that aren't going to be hits, and more producers need permission to make more podcasts that sound different and are special and aren't for everybody. It's like, it's a really wonderful thing about the medium that you can make something that's only for a few people.
Yeah, and that might actually just be for the sake of making it, which is one of the pleasures of the Spoken Web podcast for me as well, is that because there is this really strong commitment to good pedagogy as part of the way that Spoken Web as a project was designed.
Tell us what pedagogy means.
Pedagogy is teaching. It's the sort of theory of how we teach. And so
thinking
really
about teaching
sort of,
is pedagogy. Hmm? Right? Thinking about teaching is pedagogy.
Yeah. And then when you do it, I guess it's just teaching. But the sort of, you know, built into the DNA of Spoken Web as a project is this idea that students participate as collaborators and are taken seriously as colleagues and researchers and thinkers. And so often in the university, the way we treat student work is you create it for an audience of one, which is your professor, and then they give you a grade, and then you might as well shoot it into a black hole
sometimes,
for all the good it will do anybody after that.
Sometimes your mom will listen to it, and sometimes your mom will not listen to it. That's a good
point about all of the undergraduate papers that we wrote.
Right? Yeah. Just millions and millions and millions that just gone forever. But when you give students the opportunity to, like, make something, to create something that that they might share with other people, it, like, takes their work and their thinking more seriously, but it also just gives them a chance to play with how they themselves are going to create their, you know, create and share their own knowledge. And so the podcast in that sense, you know, the Spoken Web podcast in particular, does really have this ethos of, like, it is great when other people listen to these episodes, and we are delighted when episodes circulate more widely, but sometimes it's enough just that somebody made them and that experience was valuable.
I think that's a good point. And I'm curious, like, on a broader level, when the episodes are being created, who is the assumed audience, even if it is very niche? Is there... What is the thought process as far as who is the audience for the Spoken Web podcast?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the tricky things about a podcast that you decide to not prioritize consistency over, you know, the exciting possibilities of collaborative creation, because all of the sort of wisdom about building an audience is, like, you've got to create episodes consistently with a particular audience in mind. And our episodes are pretty diverse. So the primary audience, I think, is other folks who are interested in Canadian literature, literary history, sound history, sound studies, right? So students and scholars who work in these fields in general. And I think we're seeing a lot of, like, the wider scholarly community engaging with them. We're seeing the sort of wider community of poets engaging with this stuff. We're seeing episodes being brought into classrooms and used as teaching material. And so we're seeing it getting picked up in those kinds of communities. I think we, with particular episodes, we see them getting picked up more widely. More, you know, by people who are sort of more generally interested in, like, a good story about Canadian history, right? Like, we might tap into, like, that CBC listenership kind of demographic. And it really depends episode to episode.
I'm glad that you mentioned that it's being used in the classroom, because we've talked to a lot of archivists on the show. And even with my work on the Radio Preservation Task Force, there's a lot of conversation about making archives, bringing archives to life, and also making sure that people are using archives. You know, archivists want people to take advantage of the material, and that, you know, it makes all the work even more, feel even more valuable, that your work in tending to these archives is reaching a larger audience. So maybe talk a little more about that.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, librarians and archivists are part of the larger Spoken Web team, because it's a it's a project that is engaging with archives, and so they're absolutely sort of fundamental and central to this work. And so part of it absolutely is thinking about, like, how do we mobilize what lives in archives? And that's a question we're thinking about all the time, right? There's this amazing wealth of material that is, for all kinds of reasons, not necessarily finding the audiences who might love to know it's there. And we can talk about, like, the many, many barriers that exist between academic institutions and a larger public or the communities we could be serving that come, you know, are as simple sometimes as, like, special collections libraries have big, scary, thick wooden doors because they need to be climate controlled. And those doors say so loudly, you're not allowed in here. Even though actually probably you are. Probably, like, it's a public university. You absolutely can go into special collections and ask to see anything. But, like, it's a scary institution. I don't know how to, I don't, like, there's rules. I'm not allowed to have a pen.
You can't bring a pen in. I was just going to say that, which is terrifying.
There's all these rules. If I touch something wrong, am I going to be in trouble? I don't know. Do I have jam on my hands? I'm not sure. Like, it's just, you know, it's
very
really
intimidating. Yeah.
And then on top of that, right, it's like, you know, just even knowing that that stuff is there. And this is part of, again, where I think podcasting has this really interesting power, because it is a storytelling medium. And a lot of the time, to get people engaged in the interesting stuff that lives in archives, you need to tell them stories about it. You need to be like, here's what this is, and here's why you might care. And framing it within that story that sort of, you know, provides a sense of context and meaning can be a really powerful tool for mobilizing what's in archives that goes hand in hand with a project like digitization, right? Making things accessible is great, but you also have to tell people it's there somehow, even if it is accessible to them. You also have to, like, bring them to it.
As you've been going through the whole process of leading this task force related to podcasting for the Spoken Web project, Hannah McGregor, what have you learned? What has jumped out at you or surprised you along the way?
What has been sort of the most surprising and delightful thing is the kinds of innovative and exciting audio that first-time podcast producers create. It never ceases to be a pleasure to me to work with students on audio. I'm teaching a podcasting course right now. And we're just getting to the point, we're in week four, and we're just getting to the point where they're, like, giving us audio. And I was talking with a friend the other day. I was like, why is it so much better than essays? I don't understand. Like, I love reading.
Amazing. Yeah.
Why is it so much more fun to engage with student audio work? And I think it is because it's a new and different medium. And so it's like, it's a different part of your brain. It shakes you out of a lot of your sort of default thinking around, like, what schoolwork needs to be like and what you're allowed to do. It lets you be more artistic. It lets you feel like you're making something,
yeah,
rather than just sort of, like, you know, checking off the boxes on an assignment. And so there's the space for play and experimentation and unpredictability that emerges through the way that people who are brand new to the medium, you know, start to experiment with it, that is just so joyful and interesting and exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you've just given us a description of why podcasts are good. Why in, yes, 2021 we care about, you know, people talking into microphones. There's just so much more energy and diversity than there was 20 years ago on the radio, even though it was all possible, but mm-hmm. something was bottled up, and it came bursting out as soon as it went to the web.
Yeah, absolutely.
And well, and the Spoken Web series started in 2019. So in all those years, have you seen it change? Are people picking up on what other producers have done, and has it gone to a different place than when it first started, do you think?
You know, not actually. What the best change over the, so we're we're in our second year now. And the biggest change between the first and second year is that in the first year, the sort of core team of the podcast task force had to make basically all the episodes because we couldn't get anybody else to make them. Mm-hmm. We were like, come on, we'll support you. Stacey's here. We can help you. We'll give you a free license for Hindenburg. Like, well, you know, we can figure this out. And people were just like, we don't know how. And academics hate looking silly. So we're out. We're not doing it. And so we used that first season really to like model, like, here's, you know, we're going to make a ton of different styles and we're going to deliberately make episodes that are like lower barrier to access or like a little easier to produce sometimes, but some more complicated episodes so that you can like hear that like lots of different things are available. So like one will be like this quite dense, like sound documentary, but another episode is just me interviewing Stacey about her work. So you can hear like lots of different things are possible. And the great triumph of season two is that a ton of new people signed up. And so now we've got like all of these different episodes being made by all of these different people, and they sound really different because they're different creators. And so that for us felt like a real achievement. Like, we successfully convinced people and now they're making podcast episodes, and what they're making is so cool. So that felt like a win.
Right. But the theme, with that, but there's a theme, that, right? There's a, even though the diversity of producers and creators is so diverse, the show is still about the archives.
There's a thread. The show,
yeah, there is a thread. The show, I mean, the show is circles around the archives, and there will be more material to make episodes about the archives as more of the archives get digitized, because these two pieces of the project are going hand in hand. I mean, there's more than two pieces. There's like 20 task forces, I think. There's metadata task forces.
Yeah. I guess another permissions task, I guess another forces, theme, but that I'm assuming is a part of the show is just the nature of sound as the medium, yes, to be explored.
Yes, exactly. And the intersection, I think, particularly of literature and poetry and sound.
Yeah.
So some of the episodes are specifically picking up this archival audio, and others, like I said, like the Talking Drums episode is taking this question of where does sound meet literature and taking it in a different direction.
Yeah, so it sounds like the archives can be a jumping off point philosophically as well as technically.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's really cool that you sort of modeled how you wanted the podcast to go, and then people jumped in and really latched on to that idea. Is that, would you offer that same advice if there were other people with archives who are hoping to bring their archives to life? Does this model, would you recommend this model that you tried?
I mean, I think if you're trying to get lots of different folks to make episodes, then yes, I think so. I think modeling to people that there are different ways to do this kind of work is really effective. I think the biggest thing that I learned from setting up this project is we spent the whole first year putting the infrastructure in place before we put out a single episode, figuring wow. out who will do what work, what will the editorial workflows look like, where will files live, where will the podcast live, what are the timelines, what is the intended audience, what are the tone, what are the genres people can use. Like there were so many infrastructural questions to figure out because of the collaborative nature of the project. Like every time I've started a podcast, it's been like, it's 4 o'clock on a Thursday and I'm bored. Podcast o'clock, start a new project. Yeah. You can start it in no time. But this one, because it was like this big collaborative thing, the infrastructure was super key. And it's a much less sexy conversation than like the radical possibilities of working in sound. But I am so glad we took the time to get a working infrastructure in place so that now the project can like wow. can actually work.
I'm going to tease that we'll talk more about that in detail because I have a lot of questions for the podcast.
I'm curious if you could kind of tease some of the things coming up on the Spoken Web podcast. Are you able to hint at some of the topics or sounds or even some of your favorite sounds that you've heard, things that might surprise people that are in the collection?
Oh, what an interesting... Okay, so my very favorite audio archive that I have heard is a presentation that a student who works on this project did about applause, the different kinds of poetry applause.
Oh.
And that was, she had gone through and like picked out little clips of people applauding and then like created this typology of varieties of poetry applause, like the tentative applause, the reluctant applause, the spontaneous applause, as a way of like using just these little audio clips as a way to think through the sort of the way audiences relate to live poetry. And so I that is not an episode yet, but it is an episode that I would really profoundly love to like at some point draw into existence.
I hope so.
I think
it's absolutely, absolutely delightful.
I have thoughts.
But yeah.
Well, and that makes me think of, if you think about television productions or even radio productions, they probably have these stock recordings of audience applause. Yeah. So I love that idea of doing an actual, you know, looking at the real applause and understanding what all the different flavors of that are.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And it's such an interesting, it really is one of those things that like, it's something unique that is made possible by recording the live event.
Yeah.
And yeah, sometimes that gets edited out, I would think, too. And so...
A lot of the time, yeah.
Or even so just shifted or altered by the engineer or the editor. You know, you turn up the volume of the applause, you turn down, which microphone captured that applause, you know, are you hearing it from the stage, from the back of the room, from a bird's eye view? You know, there's so many choices to be made. You know, do you dampen the applause and laughter in the final recording, or do you overemphasize it because you want to trick people into thinking everyone had such a good time? Like, these are choices that radio producers make, you know. Or yeah, do you use fake applause, and no one cared in real life, but you're manufacturing enthusiasm for the work. My thanks to our guest today on Radio Survivor, Hannah McGregor, who's an assistant professor of publishing at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and who joined us on Radio Survivor to talk about their podcast, Spoken Web. Hannah was a guest on a very recent episode of Radio Survivor that you can also check out, where we spoke more about the academic peer review process of podcasts. And you can find out links to that stuff as well as other items that were of interest on today's program in our show notes online at radiosurvivor.com, where you can also listen to this episode that you just heard on the radio as a podcast. We do a weekly podcast, and which is available wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe for free. On this week's episode of the podcast with Hannah McGregor, we spoke for an additional hour about all sorts of things regarding today's topics, as well as ranging into other regions. I had a wonderful time doing a double dose of interview with Hannah McGregor, and that work is available online wherever you get your podcasts, or at RaiderSurvivor.com. We can be emailed if you want to communicate with us. Our email address is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. We are a listener and reader-supported enterprise. To find out more, you can visit radiosurvivor.com/support. My name is Eric Klein. On behalf of Jennifer Waits, who produced today's episode, and Paul Reese-Mandel, who will be back shortly, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.